from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Ryan Zinke was confirmed as Secretary of the Interior last year, he made it known he had big plans for the department. Really big plans. In fact, he said he has in mind what he's called the largest reorganization of Interior in 100 years. According to the journalist Elliot Woods, who's been writing about Zinke, the secretary wants to follow a model he's seen in the military, which changes the reporting structure. The idea is to streamline the decision-making process. But it's unclear whether such a model would work for Interior. And Woods' reporting has revealed Zinke's motives are not that clear either. He says there's some reason to believe what he's really trying to do is dismantle the regulatory structure at the department. Today in the program, Elliot Woods is joining us to talk about Ryan Zinke and where the Interior Department fits in his political ambitions. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the spring of 2015, Ryan Zinke, who at the time was a member of the Montana congressional delegation, voted against a measure to sell federal public land to the states. The journalist Elliot Wood says this was just one of the things that made him butt heads with Utah Congressman Rob Bishop. Woods describes Bishop as the driving force in Congress behind this land transfer movement. Now, fast forward a couple of years. You've got Donald Trump in the White House. Zinke is his interior secretary. And the Bears Ears National Monument, along with the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, were slated for these drastic reductions in acreage, not to mention significant changes in management policies. We're talking possibly some of the biggest changes in the department in 100 years. As Woods put it in a profile of Zinke for Outside Magazine, the Interior Secretary and Rob Bishop appear to have patched things up. Today in the program, Elliot Woods is joining us to talk about Ryan Zinke and his first year in the Interior Department, which gives us a chance to talk about what seemed to be the secretary's shifting positions on the environment and his personal and political ambitions. Elliot Woods is a correspondent at Outside Magazine. He also is a contributing editor at the Virginia Quarterly Review. He's written several articles about Zinke, including a lengthy profile, which we will put on our website, a link to that. He's joining us today from his home in Livingston, Montana. And Elliot Woods, thanks very much for joining us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
I wanted to begin before we dig in on some of the biographical stuff. And I wanted to start with just how you would characterize Ryan Zinke's tenure in Interior. So far, I mean, we'll get to the particulars, but so far, what do you make of it?
I think that Zinke's tenure thus far in the Trump administration has been similar to some of the other secretaries and characterized primarily by a real inability to actually follow through with any of the major programs that were proposed. I think that on the environment, Zinke's tenure is running in parallel with Scott Pruitt's. I think you're seeing a really aggressive campaign to dismantle any kind of environmental regulatory apparatus or infrastructure that's there, whether it's in the form of secretarial orders that are being overturned or personnel shifts and things like that. But I think the word disarray can be used to categorize the Trump administration writ large, and I think that word applies to Zinke's tenure at Interior as well.
You mentioned Pruitt, some of the things running in parallel with Pruitt. What about the ethical questions? Zinke's had his share of those problems as well.
Well, he has. I mean, it was a struggle writing the profile because I started my reporting sometime early in 2017 and finally turned in the article in the fall. And it was every other week or so that there was a new scandal, a new investigation being launched or something like that. So, yeah, I think they're on the same page in that regard as well.
It's interesting. You reported about what had happened between Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski and Ryan Zinke, that there had been reports he had tried to pressure her to vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
Apparently, they patched things up, but it does seem to reveal something about Zinke's role in the Trump administration.
It does. And, you know, this is all speculation on my part based on the same information that everybody else has and from interviews I've done, but it does seem like he is a willing enforcer. He seems to be doing things and serving in roles that don't really befit the Secretary of the Interior. And I think that that call to pressure Senator Murkowski and actually the other senator from Alaska as well was perfect example of that.
I wanted to get a sense of, you were in trying to set up this an interview with Ryan Zinke. You've talked to him before, but you wanted to get some real quality time with him. So you're trying to set up an outing with him. One of the ideas was to go into the Bob Marshall Wilderness, take horses. How did that go? I mean, I guess my question is, what was it like trying to establish an interview with him, and was, you know, how receptive was he to those ideas?
Well, it wasn't easy to get an on-location interview. It took me a few weeks or a month of actually insisting that I wanted to come and meet him in person. I offered to go to the Department of the Interior in Washington, D.C. It was very important for me and for my editor that we actually have a face-to-face interview with Ryan Zinke. But beyond that, what Outside prefers to do in these kinds of profiles of new Interior Secretaries is to actually get out somewhere with them and do something that our readers would respond to and recognize, whether it's mountain biking or fly fishing or whatever the case may be. So in this case, there were obviously a lot of opportunities in Montana, where I live and where Secretary Zinke is from. Mm-hmm. And so when I was in Alaska, I was able to arrange to meet Secretary Zinke on his visit to Denali National Park in Alaska.
Right.
And that came together very quickly. I had been asking for a few weeks, and then I got a phone call one day or an email one day that said, it was like a Thursday maybe or a Wednesday, and it said, can you be at Denali on Saturday?
Wow.
And I said, yes, I can. I'll go. So I went, and I got to shadow Secretary Zinke a lot, and we did have one face-to-face, but it was all pretty scripted, and, you know, there was a stroll through the woods on a very tame trail with his entire apparatus and some of the Denali people, and then he rode the dog sled, the dog carts, the dogs train on carts with rubber tires when there's no snow. And none of that amounted to the kind of Zinke in his element that my editor and I were really looking for. So while I was there, he mentioned that he would probably be in Montana for the Western Governors Association meeting later in June, which was about a month from that point. And so I kept in touch, and I followed up several times, and then at the very last minute, I got an email from the communications team that said, okay, Secretary Zinke will be able to meet you for 1 hour at Glacier National Park to go fishing. And I had been pressing for, like, let's get a guide and go out on a boat together. Let's get horses and go up into the Bob. And he was receptive to that idea. But in the end, all it amounted to was this pretty canned fishing jaunt at what is really probably one of the worst places you could fish in late June in Montana. The outlet of Lake McDonald, there just aren't a lot of fish there. It's just not a great, with all the options for fishing in Montana, it's really not.
Well, there are a couple of things that I think are interesting about that. One is, it seems like for Brian Zinke, these tableaus, these kind of, there's a performance element to what he does, the optics of it. Riding a horse through the streets of Washington, D.C. on his first day as Interior Secretary, those kinds of things. What does that say about him? I mean, that seems to be part of his political career, are these kind of setup pieces.
Well, it's interesting. I think, again, you can situate that in the Trump administration. We've got a president who was a reality television star. We've got another secretary, Linda McMahon. I think she's a small businesses secretary who was basically co-president of the World Wrestling Entertainment company, WWE. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of people from Fox News who are now giving top-level advice to the president on judicial issues, on foreign affairs, who are actually being brought into the cabinet and whose primary accomplishments in life are being pundits on the most controversial news entertainment site in America. So I think Ryan Zinke fits well in that spectrum. The difference with those people and Ryan Zinke is that he did actually serve as a state senator and had a pretty good reputation in Montana as a state senator. And then he did serve a term as a congressman. So he does have some experience with public service, but when it comes to the level of experience that one would need to effectively run the Department of the Interior, I don't think he has it. And so I think he is very keen to project the image of a Westerner, to project the image of somebody who knows the land so well, who is a son of the land and understands it very well. So I think it's a lot about imagery, as you say.
Well, that gets us to the other part that I think is interesting of that hour long or 45 minutes of fly fishing that you did with him. Ryan Zinke had rigged up his reel on his fly rod wrong and didn't seem to notice. Now, this is what's interesting about it is you don't actually say much about this in the piece beyond just saying that he had rigged it up wrong. And as you put it, in Montana, it's everything. So I wanted to ask you about what exactly did you mean by including that scene? It seems as if you might be saying Ryan Zinke, even though he's a resident Montanan, of course, that he might be a bit of a poser? Is that what you were getting at with that?
Well, when it comes to Zinke's fly fishing skills, and I think when it comes to his equestrian or cowboy persona as mm-hmm. well, I think he is a bit of a poser. You know, I think there's no two ways around it. But I've had a lot of conversations about that kicker in the months since the piece came out, and it wasn't an easy decision to include that. Mm-hmm. I included that almost reluctantly, but I felt like I had to because it felt like the perfect keyhole to see the entire man. That he, because when I first started reporting the story, I reported it with a fairly open mind. I'd lived in Montana for 4 years or so, and I was around for Zinke's first election campaign and his second election campaign, and I followed him through the years. But I wanted to look at the guy with a fresh set of eyes. And when I started researching and learning about the reputation that he had as a state senator and as somebody who was dependably moderate on conservation and environmental issues, he was willing to go talk to college students about the threats posed by climate change to national security. He worked with Democratic state senators to try to bring the Joint Chiefs of Staff out to Helena to address a joint session of the legislature about the threat of climate change to national security. These are not. He drove a Prius. I mean, these are not small things for a Republican in the post 9/11 age when tribal solidarity is everything on a specific few issues, including climate change. So I was very intrigued by that. And I was also, you know, as a Montanan, I was impressed to see Zinke stand up to the party on the Land and Water Conservation Fund and in very vocally saying, I will never support the sale or transfer of public lands. When he resigned from the Republican convention over the adoption of the public lands transfer plank, that was a big deal. So I wanted to see if he would carry on with that maverick persona in the Trump administration. And I was pretty disappointed to see that he hasn't at all. In fact, he has really gone full bore in the Scott Pruitt mode with regard to accommodating the coal industry, accommodating the oil and gas industry at every turn, stocking his Interior Department with former lobbyists from the mining, coal, and oil and gas industry. He's got a very extractive industry heavy cabinet, and he seems to spend a lot of his travel time trying to meet with those very same kinds of people. And so I'll say I was surprised to see how little he followed through with the persona that he had projected as a Montana congressman and as a state senator. But perhaps, you know, well, again, that's why the kicker, I think, is important, is because it was those little moments, those little details and observations that revealed to me that the entire thing from state senator forward was probably somewhat scripted.
I promise I don't want to spend too much time on this little kicker that you put in that piece, but I do think we should at least mention that there was some question as to whether or not that little kicker had annoyed the Interior Secretary enough that he had banned one of your colleagues from a telephone press conference. What do you want to say about that?
Yeah, so the conference was over Patagonia's response to the Bears Ears decision. Well, it was actually over the Bears Ears Grand Staircase Escalante decision. Yeah. It came a couple of days after that decision was made, and in the interim, Patagonia had released this very stark ad on social media that was just a black square that said, "The president stole your land." And the press conference, in the press conference, I think he was going to talk about that, though I'm not sure that any reporters knew that. At any rate, there was an email that went out to all of the relevant publications that morning saying, if you want to join this press conference, please call in and give your information. And there was supposed to be a passcode. Anyway, my colleague at Outside tried to get the passcode. He responded to say that he wanted the passcode and never got it, and eventually was able to get it from somebody else, from another journalist, and called in, gave his information, and then a voice came on the line and said, this call is only for people who were invited, and kicked him off. So, and then he tried again to get back on and could never get on. So we don't know for sure that it was because my article had just come out, I think, the Friday before. But it seems highly likely that this was a response to Outside's profile of the secretary. I actually initiated a FOIA request to see if there had been correspondence about Outside Magazine or about me or about all of that. And still, several months later now, I'm waiting on the results of that. But it would not surprise me at all. And yet, I do still find it rather troubling, because when you're talking about things like the monuments and the Bureau of Land Management, the Department of the Interior, and Patagonia especially, bringing in the outdoor community, there's not a magazine in the country that represents those interests more directly and more thoroughly than Outside. So to ban that publication would be like banning the Washington Post from covering the White House. I mean, it's pretty shocking.
We'll get deeper into this question, but I wanted to go back to that thing you were just saying a moment ago, and how it is that Ryan Zeke managed to be perceived as, in some ways, a maverick, a fairly moderate on the environment, you know, drove a Prius, interacted with Democrats, had positions on the environment that seemed surprising for a conservative Western state. How he managed to go from there to where he seems to be today, and I guess I wanted to know, is that explained by his, what you perceive as his political ambitions, or is this his ideology? Because you write about being how Ryan Zinke was influenced by his grandparents, his maternal grandparents. Their conservative values really rubbed off on him. So I'm wondering, is that ideological? Is it just ambitious? Or can you tell at this point?
I can only speculate based on the reporting that I did. Ryan Zinke would not answer that. You know, I didn't ask Ryan Zinke that question directly, and I, of course, can't get inside of his head, but my perception is that Ryan Zinke has been willing to change to fit the needs of the boss at whatever the given moment is. And if the boss is the voters in the state Senate election, then he presents a certain picture. And if it's the statewide electorate in a congressional campaign, he shifts to accommodate the state Republican Party and the National Republican Party to an extent. And now in his current role, I think he's doing what's required to please the current bosses, who if you look at the people who surround him in the Interior Department in the appointed positions, then, you know, and Rob Bishop, of course, who is the chair of the House Natural Resources Committee and has a lot of responsibility for allocations for Department of Interior and priorities for Department of Interior, then I think that he is a perfect reflection of those. His behavior reflects those pressures perfectly. So is there political ambition involved? I think, yes, there is. I mean, he very clearly came out in support of Donald Trump way ahead of the pack, which was pretty surprising to a lot of people. And he came out and then almost immediately began presenting himself as a viable candidate for vice president or for secretary of defense or any number of other positions. You know, the joke, and I don't actually know if it's apocryphal or not, it may be true, is that when Zinke got the call, so he went to Trump Tower at some point and carried a couple of copies of his memoir, American Commander, under his arm when he went to that meeting and had a meeting with Trump and left and went back to wherever he went and got a phone call that said, the president would like to offer you the position.
And he didn't know which one it was.
The joke is he said, which one?
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's true or not, but I think it's funny anyway.
Elliot Woods is with us. He's a correspondent at Outside Magazine, where he's written several articles about Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. We have a link to those on our website, radiowest.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the leadership of Ryan Zinke, the Interior Secretary. It's been just more than a year now since he took over the department, where he oversees more than 400 million acres of federal public land, hundreds of millions of acres of mineral rights and energy leases. Our guest is the journalist Elliot Woods, who's been writing about Zinke for Outside Magazine. He's joining us from his home in Livingston, Montana. So I want to ask you about this. I'd referred to this earlier. Zinke, of course, is born and raised in Whitefish, Montana. His grandfather ran a car dealership there in town. His parents got divorced, and Zinke has mentioned the kids got caught up in the middle of that fight. So he spent a lot of time with his grandparents, and you say that their values rubbed off on him, you know, being frugal and hardworking and modest. But Zinke said this, I think he either told you this or he mentioned this in his memoir, that his grandparents believed this, and I'll quote it, charity should not be a role played by our government. How much of that has rubbed off, that ideology has rubbed off in the way Zinke sees the world?
It's really hard to know, because that memoir was co-written by, I think his name is Scott McEwen. He's the same guy who co-wrote American Sniper. So it's, when you read the memoir, it's kind of like Dreams of My Father for the Republican, very pro-military reader. You know, it's clearly a book that is designed to bolster Zinke's myth and profile for future political campaigns, if I can put it that way. So there were a few places where I noted passages that seemed very clearly designed to be like a highlighted moment where a signpost where a conservative reader who's looking for a certain type of man would recognize him. And so when you see those kinds of lines, like charity is a role that's not supposed to be played by a government, you can almost hear the golf clap from the Tea Party people and from the right wing of the Republican Party compared to the compassionate conservatism of the Bush administration, which sang a slightly different tune. But so I don't know. The truth is that I don't actually know how much that's authentic and how much it's just posturing. I'm really not sure.
Isn't that the question, Elliot? In some ways, doesn't that seem to be the core of what you're trying to get at with Ryan Zinke? What's genuine and authentic, and what isn't?
Yeah, that is the core of the matter. That was the really difficult part in writing the profile, is trying to figure out what was authentic and what was just political posturing. And at the end of it, I think the betrayal of the Land and Water Conservation Fund is a pretty primary piece of evidence, because when you look at the things that Zinke really fought for as a congressman, really stood up for vociferously, LWCF was one of the major moments in his career that gave conservationists hope that this was a guy who would buck the party on conservation and public land issues, even if it meant going headlong against people like Rob Bishop, who sat at the head of the committee that I think he was on, the most important committee that he was on. So when he did not stick up for the Land and Water Conservation Fund as the Trump budget process began, when the Trump budget first started to be rolled out and it looked like there were going to be huge cuts, greater than 10% to the entire Department of the Interior, and higher than that to certain parts of the Department of the Interior, Zinke didn't push back against those cuts at all. And one of those cuts was to Land and Water Conservation Fund. And now with the fiscal year 2019 budget proposal from Trump, that those cuts to LWCF are almost total. I mean, they reduce the Land and Water Conservation Fund to almost zero. And Zinke has not said a word about that. He's not protested that in any way. So this
makes me think of Scott Pruitt, and I'm wondering how far the comparison between the two can go. Scott Pruitt, it seems, has a clearly ideological design on the EPA. Would you say Ryan Zinke does as well for Interior, or is it just his sense?
I don't think so. Or if he does, then his ideology is very malleable.
Okay.
Whereas I think, Scott Pruitt came into politics as somebody who was already very closely aligned with the oil and gas industry and the extractive industry, and already very hostile to environmental regulation.
Yeah.
He came in with that ideological bent, or he developed that ideological bent a long time ago because it served him in his career. And Ryan Zinke didn't come into politics that way. He came into politics as a relative unknown. And in fact, after my profile was published, I got contacted from a reporter friend of mine here in Montana who's been covering state politics for a long time, who reminded me that Ryan Zinke wasn't the favorite for the 2014 congressional campaign that he won, but rather he took the lead after the two primary candidates basically sabotaged each other. So there were two front-running Republicans who took the wind out of each other's sails to such an extent that Ryan Zinke was able to emerge as the winner of that primary, but that he was not even widely popular throughout the state in the Republican primary that year. And he grew on Montanans, I think, after he was elected, but he didn't come with those alliances to the extractive industry the way that some other Republican politicians have. And so I think he developed those as a state senator and then as a congressman. And now I think he is very much indebted to those people who helped him win in Montana in 2014 and 2016, and who he now is basically working for as Secretary of Interior. So I don't think that it's ideology in the same way that it is for Scott Pruitt. I think it's just as damaging and just as dangerous.
So who do you figure, if Ryan Zinke isn't necessarily, and maybe he is, but for political ambition's sake, but who's designing the massive reorganization to the Department of the Interior? Is that inspired in part by some of the, some of the skeptics of the deep state within the Trump administration, people like Steve Bannon before, that were looking to dismantle some of these structures? That is it Zinke, or is he letting others influence him in that way?
Well, there's been a... This is not the first time that this idea has been proposed. So it's a resurrection of an idea that's been around for a while that the Department of Interior should be moved out west. So in terms of who's actually pulling the puppet strings and pushing Zinke to do this, I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think this could just be an idea that Zinke had on his own that he had heard about from previous administrations. But I think it's become a big talking point for him because it sounds really good to right-wing Westerners who, as you say, are worried about the deep state, who have strong resentment of the federal government and of the federal land management agencies. So it's a good talking point, while at the same time being such a monstrously huge project that there's really no chance that it could actually be done. You know, that's kind of the red herring of it all, is that for one thing, there are only a couple of hundred. There's almost 70,000 employees in the Department of the Interior, and only a couple hundred of them are in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, yeah.
So this notion that you need to move the Department of the Interior out of D.C. is wrongheaded to begin with, because the Department of Interior isn't really in D.C. That's where the headquarters building is. But the people who manage the Bureau of Land Management field offices and the national parks and the Bureau of Rec and Bureau of Indian Affairs offices, these people have enormous autonomy, and those field offices are pretty robust and independent already. And what's one of the things that's really interesting to me is that a lot of the pushback to this idea has come from governors of Western states who say, wait a second, if you've got a manager out here who's responsible for the Southern Colorado River watershed, then who do I liaise? You know, how much pull do I have with that guy if he's representing five different states? Whereas when it's somebody like the Montana Dakota's field office, then those governors build a very good rapport with that field office manager. And they feel like the priorities of their state are better represented in that scenario. So there's actually a lot of pushback to this idea from governors, including Matt Mead of Wyoming, who's a Republican.
Yeah. Explain the idea a little bit more, if you would, Elliot, and maybe because this is something that I want people to get a sense of just what this restructuring means. Basically, there's this idea called joint management agencies. And the idea is these are based on not geographic regions the way things are now. They're based on ecosystems. And I just wanted you to explain that a little bit for people, because it seems like in theory, managing these areas based on ecosystems rather than just sort of man-made regions seems to make some sense in theory anyway.
In theory, it does. And as one of my colleagues wrote it outside, it's not a bad idea. It's just 100 years too late. Because at this point, you've already got all of the infrastructure in place for the geographic district, basically the political district, to be the management district for these agencies. So changing that would be an enormous task. But let me back up and explain what Zinke is proposing. So yes, it would be an ecosystem-based management model where the offices and the personnel would be devoted to a specific ecosystem. And what I've primarily heard of as the basis for those ecosystems is watersheds, which makes a lot of sense. So it would be, you know, the Missouri River watershed joint management area of Montana and the Dakotas, for example, or something like that. And you'd have the Columbia River or something like that out in the Pacific Northwest. And what's especially bold about the plan is that Zinke is proposing to combine the different personnel from the different land management agencies into that same joint management office.
Right.
So you might have the superintendent of Yellowstone National Park is in charge of the Yellowstone River joint management area. And that means that superintendent would be in charge of a Bureau of Land Management fisheries biologist who was researching smallmouth bass intrusions into Yellowstone River 250 miles away in eastern Montana. And then you might have, you know, budget and management personnel from the Bureau of Rec or something like that. So basically, he's got this idea from Joint Special Operations Command, where you might have a Navy SEAL in charge of units of Army Rangers and Marine Force Recon and Special Operations and Army Delta Force, and they're all in the same command center taking orders from the same person who might not wear the same uniform that they do, but they're all executing different aspects of what is essentially the same mission.
But do they translate? I mean, you get at this in the piece.
Well, on the surface, it's an intriguing idea, but that's just not how these agencies work. And the thing for me is, when you talk about Joint Special Operations Command, you're talking about a very tiny part of the military that's devoted to a very specific task. Yeah. When you're talking about the Bureau of Land Management, you're talking about an enormous, sprawling agency. It's one of the biggest agencies in the federal government that's responsible for huge sections of the American landscape and everything from law enforcement to scientific research to range management to mining to oil development on public land to coal. I mean, there's a lot going on, and each one of these agencies has its own protocols with regard to how all of this should be done, and they all have different priorities. So, for example, the Bureau of Reclamation has quite different priorities about how natural resources are managed than the Bureau of Land Management does, or the National Park Service does, or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The Bureau of Reclamation's job is to steward water for the use of people in the West, primarily. And so they have a very different idea about what the job is than somebody who's working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service doing fisheries research or something like that. So it isn't, and they all have their own institutional culture as well. So what Zinke seems to be proposing is, let's just eliminate all of the different signs, and people can keep their uniforms, but we'll just, you know, if you're a fisheries biologist, again, to use that example with Fish and Wildlife Service, and you want to apply for a job with BLM, you can just stay with the Fish and Wildlife Service, but you'll go work in their office, in this new joint management office, and your boss might be the old BLM guy. It's not going to work.
So why do it? I mean, some of the people you talked with in your piece said that, look, on some level, yes, this maybe could... there could be some efficiencies here. But one person said, really, it looks like more an effort at dismantling.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Because what you would get with all of this is a lot of... So Zinke has said that he wants to cut the Department of Interior staff by several thousand people. And this would be one way to do that. If you could combine some of these offices, then you could get rid of personnel. So... and you would also reduce the number of people in authoritative positions who can actually push back against some of the more disturbing policy coming down the pipeline. Hmm. You know, in the age of Trump, some of the people who occupy positions of authority in large government agencies have been able to offer quite a bit of resistance. And the fewer of those people that you have at the senior management level, the fewer of them you have to worry about. So if you streamline all of these offices, then you get rid of a lot of headaches, I guess.
Elliot Woods is with us. He's a correspondent at Outside Magazine. We have links to his articles about Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Elliot Woods. We're talking about his reporting on Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. He's joining us from his home in Livingston, Montana. Elliot Woods, I wanted to ask you, last year you interviewed Zinke, we were talking about that, and in a conversation you had with him, he was complaining about how the revenues from natural resource commodities had really crashed, and I wanted to ask you about that. What's interesting about that complaint is that he doesn't think it was just the economy that had changed, because, the demand for oil and gas is really tanking right now, but he said it was because, and this is how he put it, that regulatory framework had become punitive and arbitrary. So talk us through that. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think he was primarily talking about the Planning 2.0 rules that the BLM implemented during the Obama administration and some of the aspects of the National Environmental Policy Act protocols that are required for getting people out onto the ground to drill or excavate or mine. So basically his primary complaint when I've talked to him and when I've listened to him speak is that from the time that somebody applies for, or from the time that somebody wins a bid on a lease to take coal or oil or whatever out of the ground, from that date until the date when they are actually out on the ground drilling takes way too long. And so one of his major priorities was to speed up that process. And the way that he set about doing that was to eliminate a lot of these regulations. One of the first ones that he went after was the methane rule, which has not been entirely successful yet. But he very clearly gave his people marching orders to expedite the permit approval process for people who wanted to operate on public land. And when he talks about the process becoming punitive and arbitrary, it's hard to really know what he's talking about because the Obama administration actually saw a huge growth in the amount of onshore and offshore development of oil and gas. So I think I don't have the numbers right in front of me right now, but I want to say that onshore increased by something like 50% over the course of the Obama administration, and that's primarily fracked oil. And then the gas production also shot through the roof during the Obama administration, but then it tanked really hard because they created their own supply glut.
Yeah.
When he says that the regulatory apparatus became punitive and arbitrary, it's another one of those head scratchers because it seems like access was not a problem under the Obama administration. What was the problem was supply, problems of supply and demand and how that affects the market. So revenues to Interior through royalties tanked because the value of the commodity coming off the land tanked, like literally dropped in the case of oil from close to $150 a barrel in 2008 at its peak to less than $40 a barrel in 2016.
You argue in your writing that by offering these public land and offshore energy leases right now, he's basically conducting, I think, what you've called kind of a fire sale. He's offering these leases to oil and gas companies now while the prices are low. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's the idea. That's the consensus from several people who have studied the oil and gas industry who I interviewed for that piece is that what the industry gets out of it is they get to pick up these leases and pad their portfolios with them, which makes them more attractive to investors, but they're getting them at the minimum bid price or at a very low bid price. So I think something like 30%, and again, I don't have these numbers right in front of me, but I think it's something like 30% of leases in 2016 or 17 went for the minimum bid price. Which is a pretty good score for an oil and gas company. So then they can sit on it and wait for the market to improve, and then they can go in and develop it when and if the market improves. They have the lease for 10 years, and it's pretty easy to renew these leases as well, and they pay a very low per acre rental fee throughout the lifetime of that lease that I think is less than $2 an acre. I think that's one of the ideas, but I also think it's another form of posturing. It's just a way for him to come out and say, I'm on your side. I'm doing everything I can to open the door for you. We will not stand in your way. when if you actually peek behind the curtain and look at what the industry is doing, there isn't a lot of demand for these leases.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of hardcore fringe of the onshore oil and gas development community that wants, you know, to break down every single aspect of environmental regulation, that wants to circumvent NEPA, that wants to streamline all of that stuff to make it really easy to get out there on the land. But they don't represent a majority of the industry. And in terms of how the industry is behaving, there's just not a lot of demand. So, for example, Ryan Zinke has held several major offshore oil leases over the last year and also put up parts of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Mm-hmm. And the response on those lease sales has been very marginal. I mean, something like less than 1% of tracts offered get bid on. And again, check those numbers, but it's that low.
But the idea, this is something you've been writing about too, that the economy is kind of moving on. A lot of places in the West, diversifying economic, certainly toward more and more recreation. And I guess the question is whether or not Zinke has the Interior Department in a position right now to embrace some of those other changes.
Well, he did I just read in the news yesterday that he is apparently pushing forward with a more aggressive attempt to get wind farms offshore on the Atlantic coast. So that would probably be a way to position the BLM for the future, but that's certainly not where the priorities are under Zinke. The priorities are very much in the realm of the old extractive industries, coal, oil and gas, and hard rock mining. Mm-hmm. And it's people from those industries who are filling out his political appointees. So I think the answer is that Zinke's not positioning the Bureau of Land Management for the future. In fact, he's really moving the BLM back. This Planning 2.0 process that President Obama's Secretary of the Interior initiated, or that the BLM under the Obama administration initiated, was seen as a very important step forward to recognizing the new brand of multiple use in an era where the recreation economy, for example, is approaching $1 trillion now, where you have hundreds of thousands of citizens in Western states who live there, who in some cases have moved there because of the abundant public land and healthy ecosystems, and they're very conservation minded. And the new multiple use that was represented in the Bureau and BLM's Planning 2.0 was supposed to recognize that changing demographic, was supposed to recognize that this isn't the old days where the primary priority of the BLM is just getting things out of the ground and off the land and working with people who are doing that, that the BLM has to factor in all of these other concerns about the landscape. And so in eliminating Planning 2.0, Zinke is really taking a step backwards, unfortunately.
I wanted to tease out two quotes that you've cited in your writing about Zinke. One was at an energy conference in Houston last month, where he said, "Interior should not be in the business of being an adversary. We should be in the business of being a partner." And then you also quote him at a gathering of oil industry executives as saying, I'll quote him here, "I got 30% of the crew that's not loyal to the flag." Mm-hmm. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that he means that 30% of the Department of the Interior is not on board with his priorities. And when he's talking about the flag, is he talking about the United States, or is he talking about his own secretarial flag, or is it just, I think it's just a metaphor that he's using. I think it's just a cliche that he's using. Mm-hmm. But what he means is they're not loyal to him,
yeah,
and they're not loyal to the priorities that he has brought to the Department of the Interior, namely with regard to dismantling the environmental regulatory apparatus and streamlining the permitting approval process for people who want to operate on public land and making it as easy as possible for them to do so. People who are pushing back against that in any way. I think that's who he's talking about. And I think I think President Trump has said similar things about the CIA and the FBI and I think it's of a stripe with those comments, that they have a very radical agenda with regard to these agencies and are pushing for serious changes in how they operate. And there are people in those agencies who are pushing back, and with good reason. And I think that's who he's talking about. But again, as a former military commander, that kind of statement from Ryan Zinke is really surprising to me, because it's not a good thing for officers in the military to disparage their own troops. One of the primary functions that a senior commanding officer provides in the military is morale boosting, is to keep the troops in the fight, to keep them happy, to keep them healthy, well-fed, well-rested to the greatest degree possible. And when none of those things are possible, to just boost their spirits with encouraging talk. And so to come out and disparage them is exactly the opposite of what is expected of a leader at his level.
You were about out of time, Elliot. Well, let me ask you finally, you ask this question in your piece, you ask of a conservation advocate, how much damage can Zinke do? What's the answer that you're getting finally?
I think the answer is a lot. I think that a lot of these, for example, Planning 2.0, or the sage-grouse management plan, these are things that were great improvements to how management was done and organized, and that took years and years and years to work out. And to roll them back with a signature is pretty damaging. You can't get all those people in a room again. It took a lot of money. It took a lot of time. It took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And it's much easier to undo those things than it is to redo them. So I think the answer is a lot. And as with elsewhere in the administration, I think the danger of incompetence is also very real. I think, you know, if you simply can't do the job that's expected of you, that in itself is extremely damaging. And so that's what I worry about probably more than anything.
It's Elliot Woods, a correspondent at Outside Magazine. We have linked to his articles about Ryan Zinke on our website, radiowest.org. He joined us from his home in Livingston, Montana. Elliot, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.